You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splat!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. No, this isn't Troy. Troy's actually in Las Vegas, or on his way to Las Vegas, for his honeymoon. So you're just going to get myself and, of course, as always, Jeff. Jeff Herr, the Jeff Report. Jeff.
That was me.
How are you doing tonight?
Yes. I am doing okay. I am exhausted. It's been a busy weekend, busy day. I'm getting a new car tomorrow.
Sweet.
Car. So not a new car, but it's new to me.
Sure. So there you go. It's kind of like Jason Vargas. He's not a new pitcher, but he's new to us.
You know what? I could not have thought of a better Royals comparison. That's why you're the best in the business, Michael Engel.
What kind of car is it?
It's a Mitsubishi Endeavor. It's an SUV. I was looking for something initially that got really good gas mileage, and yeah, I ended up with this. So I think the recent weather probably had a little something to do with that, because it's four-wheel drive.
Yeah, and there's about 2 feet of snow on the ground.
Yeah, so that'll help. And I live in a hilly area, so. But yeah, so that's exciting. But it's been kind of busy going over the weekend and looking for everything, and then calling people, insurance and all that stuff today, getting all that stuff figured out, and so I'll go pick it up tomorrow. But other than that, I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Oh, not too bad. The busy time of my workload is kind of cooled down and slowed down and quieted down, so about another month it'll pick back up and it'll be crazy again, but that's okay. That's fine, because by that point we'll be right in the middle of spring training and spring training games, which, of course, we're recording this on February 10th, so it's a Monday. So there's a lot of news from today, but there's probably going to be some maybe by the time you listen to this, or if you listen to it in the middle of the week. But yeah, Friday, pitchers and catchers report to surprise for the Kansas City Royals. So that is probably the best news of anything that you can come up with for this time of year, especially with, like I said, a couple feet of snow outside. Pretty exciting about that. The Royals held a little bit of a press conference today to talk about some of those things, and we're going to talk about those just here in a little bit. Also, later on the show, I talked with Brett Parker, who he's the guy who organized Dress to the Nines last year, which was pretty good success for being completely, built up over 8 days via Twitter. This year, it's an official promotion for the Royals, so that's pretty exciting. There's a lot of really cool stuff going on with that, but that's going to be at the end of the show. Let's do some cleanup. Let's just some stuff that we maybe haven't talked about a whole lot. I mean, we can touch on this very briefly. The Royals unveiled their slogan. It's Be Royal. I don't really have a strong opinion either way about this. I know Ben over on Walk Off Talk does. I don't care. I mean, it's a slogan. Anytime you get the marketing department involved, it's probably going to be pretty, pretty lukewarm kind of thing. They went on, they hung their necks out with Our Time and kind of got burnt for it. So I don't blame them for playing it safe and trying to be trendy with Be Royal. Do you have any strong opinions on this slogan, Jeff?
No, not really. I'm kind of with you. Is what it is. Doesn't really. You got it. They've got to have one for whatever reason. They've decided they have to have a slogan. And I've definitely heard worse for the Royals slogan. So Be Royal is fine. It's kind of kitschy with the song. And we're going to hear that damn song who knows how many times this summer. So be ready for it. but I will say, whether the slogan is cool or not, they've been just killing the billboards both last year and this year. Last year they had the one with James Shields pitching, where it was one billboard on either side of the highway and he was throwing the ball in one, and in the other it was being caught by Sal Perez, I think, and it had they made it look like it was tearing out the billboards. There was a whole chunk in the middle of the billboard that was missing. That was really cool. And then this year, it's kind of a similar thing. It's a bunch of different random ones where they're sliding, and the sliding into the base, they've kind of made it look like they're, when they slide in, they're pulling the billboard with them, and it's kind of crumpled up like it's a, I don't know, so whatever, but it's pretty cool. So, what, you know, regardless of their slogan, they're doing a pretty good job with those.
They're like halfway there, pretty much.
Yeah.
Now, if some of that could translate to the field, that would be much better.
That would, yes.
Just a couple of transaction things that happened earlier today. Emilio Bonifacio was, the Royals requested release waivers on him, unconditional release waivers, which means teams can claim him and I believe take the full salary for him. But if he goes through 48 hours without being claimed, he becomes a free agent. And at that stage, I believe the Royals are on the hook for 1/6 of his salary because he was arbitration eligible. You know, we kind of touched a little bit, and others have talked about Bonifacio, and you know, I pretty good utility guy, but I don't know for $3.5 million how well he would fit on this team, especially with, you know, still other things that the Royals probably need. I don't think Bruce Chen's going to be the answer at in the rotation, but you know, that's what the Royals kind of chose. They chose Chen over Bonifacio, so he's going to be gone, and that kind of unleashes a lot of other little things about construction of the roster and how things are going to go. We know who the 9 starters are going to be, and we know Billy Butler is going to be, you know, the DH, and we know Omar Infante is going to be at second. Thing we just don't know is if they're going to carry both Jerod Dyson and Justin Maxwell, and then if they will take someone like Pedro Siriaco or Christian Colon or Jason Donald, or if they're going to stick with Danny Valencia and kind of see what happens as far as the first couple weeks of the season. So, but it was also kind of confusing because the Royals, it felt like they would have had an opportunity to trade Bonifacio, and apparently there either weren't offers that were worth anything or there was some kind of snag in there. I mean, what are your thoughts on how this kind of played out, Jeff?
It's kind of weird, and I think we kind of touched on either this last week or something kind of related where it just feels like a move where, you know, there was kind of the directive of, hey, I know we've got a record payroll, but I want to save some more money, so cut $3 million, you know, wherever you can. I don't care where it is. And so Bonifacio was the first guy on the block, you know, and it was just because, I mean, what was his number? It was like 3 point something million,
3.5, and they designated him for assignment to sign Bruce Chen for 3.25. So yeah. I mean, it's pretty convenient that those numbers pretty much match up.
Yeah, and I mean, a guy like Bonifacio, that kind of money is a little bit much to pay him for what he, for the amount of playing time he would probably get. But all the same, like, he can be a valuable player, and he showed that in a short stint with the Royals last year. So it's just a matter of, you know, is he worth that money to the Royals? And they decided that he wasn't. And I mean, if they were in a different position, they were a different team, they probably would have kept him. But being as they're the Royals and they probably needed to cut something somewhere, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, it does throw kind of some questions out there with what their scenario is going to be for, you know, backup infielders and so forth. But I mean, I imagine that'll all kind of work itself out as it usually does.
And, you know, you brought up a good point about, you know, kind of the keeping the payroll at a certain level. We saw it with Jeremy Guthrie cutting $3 million off of this year's salary. That kept the payroll down a little bit. And then this move as well. And you know, Andy McCullough, who has just taken over for Bob Dutton at the Kansas City Star as the new beat writer. Talented guy. He's about 24 years old, so he looks like he's about high school age. But he tweeted earlier there after that press conference that Dayton Moore said the Royals' budget is going to be about $90 million for 2014, which that's kind of what it was looking like for a while. But he also noted that Moore said that's the break-even point. And later that...
Past their break-even point.
Past their break-even point. And that this payroll is a gamble. So, and we've talked about payroll and small market and the Royals and everything, but I mean, $90 million, that is a franchise record payroll, but it's not too far off from last year's payroll, and compared to the rest of the league, it's not outrageous. So I mean, I don't get where this is a break even. I obviously don't have the financials myself in front of me, but you've got $25 million coming from the national TV contracts. You've got, you know, coming off of a winning season, I don't see how that can be a break-even point when they weren't really losing money beforehand. And obviously there's more things that go into it than just the payroll. There's operations, there's scouting, there's the minor leagues, there's stadium maintenance and things like that. But they've been able to operate without going into the red before this. And it just seems like $7 million extra payroll really shouldn't be pushing them too far over the edge. You're much more of a numbers and finances guy than I am. So what's your take on where this is all sitting?
Well, I think that this is, it's incredibly arbitrary. Like, and you can make, like, in financial terms, like break even. I mean, you can say that, oh, it's a past their break-even point where, you know, that could be from like a budgeting standpoint, and they're trying to budget in a profit of $15 million for the year. And so it's like, oh, we want to make $15 million, and in order to do, you know, that's because that's what we want to break even or whatever. And so, I mean, to call it past their break-even point, like, that could be them kind of doctoring some things, you know, not necessarily in a fraudulent standpoint, but in just in terms of how it's presented to the public. And so I don't really buy it. I mean, like you said, I just pulled up Baseball Reference while you were talking about it, and the payroll last year, according to baseballreference.com, was $80.4 million for the Royals. So if they're at about 90 right now, that's $10 million more, and they were not past the break-even point last year. They're $10 million more. And every team is getting, what is it, $20 million extra? $25 million extra in TV revenue. So, I mean, you don't have to be a math major to figure that one out, that they're not crowing about being past the break-even point last year, and they added $10 million, and they're already right off the top getting an extra $25 million. Well, that gives them an extra $15 million, theoretically, to play with. And you know, here they are harping on, you know, poor Royals, we're just, you know, past our break-even point, and look at us, look at how much we want to win. And, you know, it's, and called this before where it was going to happen like this, where they're going to say, oh, you know, we're really at the top of our budget, but, you know, we're going to do it for this year because we really, really want to win and all that stuff. So, I mean, to me, it's a load of crap, to put it bluntly. So, I do appreciate, I mean, they get credit for going up to $90 million because it is a record payroll, and something that they haven't shown the willingness to do before. But all the same, you know, calling it their break, you know, just go out and be honest and just be like, hey, you know, we're a small market team. We want to operate with a smaller budget, and we've set our payroll at $90 million. And I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm nitpicking too much because not like that's the first time. But just to call it a break-even point just makes it seem like, oh, you know, like they're trying to put this face out there where, oh, you know, we're so close to losing money, and we're, you know, we are going to lose money because we're past that break-even point, and that's what, you know, we're only doing this because we want to win. And it's just, it doesn't jive with me. So I don't like when I hear stuff like that, because I just, and they won't open, you know, no teams, any professional sports will open their books to really show us in those situations, you know, what it's like. So, I don't know. I mean, I would rather them just be honest and say, hey, we've set our payroll at $90 million. If I have an absolutely, you know, unbelievably good reason to go over, I'll consider it. But until that time comes, here we are, and that's where we're going to stay. So.
Right. And that makes sense. I mean, and credit to the Royals, like you said, I mean, they have spent money, and ever since Dayton Moore's been there, they've invested in the farm system and the minor leagues and in development a lot more. You know, bonuses are through the roof. They're one of the top international spenders usually. So they're doing that part, and, you know, 2 years of record payroll. So there is something to that, and you can't really, I don't think the glass is cheap narrative really fits, because he's not really being cheap, but there is still some tightening of the belt here and there that they've got to do. And I mean, he's a businessman. It's still a business. It's understandable that they would do that. But at the same time, to me, it feels like there's almost some implied additional revenue that you could get by putting out an exciting team that really screams like they're going to be a potential winner. And guys like Jason Vargas, you know, don't really do that. Guys like Bruce Chen, who you can sign for that amount because nobody else is really talking to him, or it doesn't seem like anybody else is talking to him. I don't have a source that says that there weren't, but, you know, there wasn't any noise on him earlier. So it seems like, you know, this is kind of playing with the narrative and playing with how it's being perceived. And then, yeah, just like you said, if they do come out and say, hey, look, we've spent this, this is what we're doing, you know, then they can kind of come out ahead. And they have done that before. They did that last year as well, where they said that they were limited in some ways, and then they went and did, you know, a couple extra moves and things like that. So I don't know. I mean,
and there's a phrase in the business world, right? Say they, which is kind of, I don't necessarily agree with 100%, but, you know, you got to spend money to make money. And while it's not quite that black and white, the whole, the takeaway from, you know, how that became an expression is the idea that you have to invest in your product in order to make a good product that's going to get you money in return. So the Royals have always kind of just magically hoped they've been good enough to get extra money, whereas, you know, other teams have been like, okay, we can pay more for some free agents, we can give some contracts to the guys that we develop, and our payroll is going to be higher, but we're going to be better, and it's going to come back to us, you know, in merchandise sales, ticket sales, you know, whatever you want it to be. So that's another thing that, you know, it's something that it doesn't seem like the Royals kind of think that way. They think a different way, which I suppose is fine, but it's interesting that they just don't seem at all anywhere close to that kind of way of thinking.
And in a lot of ways, that does kind of hamper them in trying to go after some people, because right now we've got, you know, Irvin Santana, who had a great year last year, and a lot of people really hoping that he was going to come back to Kansas City, seemed to like it here, said all the right things, was really big on the Chiefs all offseason. And really, I think everybody liked him. He had a good year, and there are a lot of people who he converted and a lot of people who still believed in his ability. Stadium's a good fit, but the money's just not going to be there. And it's because they've gone and they've signed some of these Jason Vargas and Bruce Chen types that, you know, if you don't sign those guys, you could probably get them for $11 million this year and not have that kind of awkward-looking rotation with James Shields and Vargas and Jeremy Guthrie and Bruce Chen, and then try to scramble and fit the pieces together for the other guys. But it seems like Santana hasn't even really been on the radar. It seems like he is close to, I've heard, Orioles, Blue Jays, and Mariners is three of the top teams. So I'm kind of interested to see where he goes with that. It's pretty clear that the Royals are not going to be anywhere near him. It doesn't seem like they were in on some of the other pitchers that have signed in other places either. It's a weird pitching market, and the Royals are really kind of, I don't know how well they've navigated it so far.
Yeah, and you know, there's, I mean, you know, deja vu, right? Like, we've been here before. You know, with the Bruce Chen signing, where Dayton Moore actually came out and admitted 2 years ago that he misread the market. And then, I mean, they re-signed Guthrie last year, which, you know, all of us on this show, I think we were kind of, you know, we didn't have a problem with that signing. It was decent money.
Yeah, I liked it enough.
It was it was needed, you know, because that was before Santana and before the James Shields. Was the new contract before the James Shields trade?
Yeah, it was. They had, I think the way it went, they traded for Santana on Halloween or the day after.
Yeah.
And then they got Guthrie somewhere around Thanksgiving. And then Shields was in the middle of December.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to that point, yeah, at that point, they only had Santana and a lot of nothing else and, you know, didn't really know what they were going to do as far as top of the rotation.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was a pretty solid move on their part and wasn't a huge deal. But the whole Vargas thing, like, when – I mean, it was so obvious. Everybody knew that Masahiro Tanaka was going to, you know, was going to set the market. He was going to be the first domino that fell that set the whole thing in motion. And that kind of rippled over not even just to – the pitching market, but just free agency in general, because teams didn't know how much they were going to spend on pitching, so they didn't know how much they were going to be able to spend on anything else. And so the idea that the Royals kind of, I don't know if it was something where Dayton Moore didn't even realize that Tanaka was going to set the market and he should wait, or he realized that and thought he was exploiting some sort of inefficiency by jumping out ahead of the curve and trying to sign somebody like Vargas, you know, really quick. And then you kind of hamstring yourself because, I mean, with pitchers like Irvin Santana who are still out there, I know he's got the draft pick tied to him, which makes it a little bit different. But if someone like Santana is still out there, then, you know, you're going to be in a position. And Arroyo, you know, was still out. When those pitchers are still out there, you know, well into free agency, past the Tanaka signing, and I got to think Vargas would have still been available. You know, I don't know. Maybe somebody would have snatched him up just like the Royals did. But I don't know. You know, it's just a – I really think that it's one of those – you really have to question, which, you know, we all have before, but whether Dayton Moore has the ability to read a market. And it does – you know, from past evidence, it doesn't appear that he has. He's made some decently smart moves, but the more often than not, they have not been smart, at least in terms of quick free agent signings.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something where, you know, I've always wondered this, how does David Glass evaluate the job that Dayton Moore is doing and all aspects of it? You know, he seems kind of hands off, and I'm not sure what Dan Glass is involved in all that evaluation process, but it seems like if I would own the Royals, I would look at this and I'd say, you know what? I mean, I'd go to Dayton Moore and I'd say, why don't we have Bronson Arroyo? Why weren't we able to swing a deal like the Brewers did? You know, why can't we get Santana back? You know, I know I limit you with the money, but you're the one that spent it. And so you've already spent it in this way. Why? And, you know, if he shows based on his answers and everything that he, you know, that he's deficient in that area, I don't know why you don't say, okay, you're great at scouting. You know, I want you to be the general manager. You be the face. You're, you know, pretty good at the press conferences, scout, get all that together. And then I'm going to hire somebody else, call him the VP of whatever, and they're going to handle all the major league moves. You know, like, I don't understand where that's coming from. Where, I mean, we're kind of getting off topic here, but that's just something I've always kind of wondered, you know, why doesn't somebody step in and say, okay, Dayton Moore, you have done some good things for this organization. We want you to keep doing those good things, but here's where you're deficient. I'm going to fix this. I'm going to make you realize you're deficient. We're going to bring somebody in to figure this out. I've just never understood.
Yeah. I think the Rockies tried that for a while, but I don't know if they're still doing it or if it's done anything major or anything. It's an interesting idea, and it's definitely something that they might as well think about, because you're right, it is a pattern. It just keeps happening. It's like the patented post World Series trade that always seems to happen. It's the same thing. I don't know. It's a strange kind of scenario where they do have to, you know, Glass has to oversee him, and I think we're happy that he doesn't intrude too much, because that was a real big problem with Allard Baird. But at the same time, you know, he still has to kind of keep an eye on that stuff. And either he's not doing it, or he doesn't care, or he completely agrees with trying it that way, which is a whole other matter. Anyway, let's move on to the to another.
Far too long on that one. So yeah, we'll keep it moving.
Let's try another one. You know, just let's just get this out of the way real quick. The Royals traded, and this was a couple weeks ago, traded for Carlos Puguero, outfielder. Big dude. He's like 6'5", 260 or something. Huge guy. Left-handed slugger. Strikes out a lot. Has a lot of power, like 500-foot home run type of power. I think Dave Cameron of Fangraphs described him as having what he said was, imagine Jeff Francoeur, then take away his plate discipline. So that both that ended up getting Everett Tiefert designated for assignment. He's cleared waivers. He's been assigned to Omaha. So, you know, Royals keep an arm in the system that way. Pretty minor move. But let's go back to, you know, we were talking before the show, and you were talking about Santana and kind of how the market's developed. And Bronson Arroyo just signed for, I think it was 3 years and like $30 million total, or maybe it was 2 years with a third option year or something like that. Pretty decent deal. Guy who never gets hurt, always is able to get the innings. Not a lot of upside, but, you know, I think more than, say, Bruce Chen, and definitely more reliable than Jason Vargas. And really, these are guys that the Royals didn't really have an opportunity for. But back to Santana, you know, now he's got, you were talking before about, you know, the selection and kind of what his idea of his market was before the free agency really started. And then what it is now after Tanaka and after a couple of months of just quiet.
Yeah, and I think it's really kind of interesting. There's a lot of moving parts to this, and I don't want to get too high level and out there. But when you look at – which I never do, right?
We never do on this show, so.
Yeah. but when you look at it and you say, okay, from a baseball standpoint, everyone gives them all this credit – for, you know, having so much years of labor peace, and ever since the strike in 94, they haven't had any labor problems and negotiated CBAs and all this stuff. But then you have all these contracts that are out of control, and then you have situations like this really weird pitching market this offseason that I don't know that we've really seen one like this in recent history. You know, the past year, you have, you know, a couple massive signings. Clayton Kershaw wasn't a free agent, but all the same, he got a just ginormous deal, biggest in Major League history from an average annual value standpoint. And then you've got the Tanaka signing, which was the biggest foreign player signing in history. But then, God, I'm drawing a blank. Brewers, the
Garza.
Garza, thank you. I wanted to say Dempster, but I was like, it's not Dempster, it's Garza. Thank you. So and then Brewers signed Garza for really reasonable deal, and then it's kind of like, whoa, everything's changed, and you've got players like Irvin Santana, who was hoping for like a 7-year, $100 million type contract, and then now he's kind of dialed it back down to earth because he doesn't have a choice, because he's probably not as good as Garza, and he's not going to get more money than he did. So it's a question of, you know, how much is he really worth? And it actually has kind of evened out to get them, you know, get pitchers closer to not being overpaid. And then you've got this thing where the Royals can give Santana a qualifying offer, which means the team has to give up a draft pick, which puts just another wrinkle into it. So teams are probably going to sign a shorter deal that's cheaper, so they don't, you know, so they can kind of stomach signing someone like Santana. And so he's got to worry about, I think the reason he threw out that, you know, $100 million contract number is because he won't have to worry about anything like that for the rest of his life. He wanted this to be his last contract, and then he'd go off right off into the sunset. Well, now he's got to worry about a second contract. So it's a little bit different for him because it's, you know, where does he go? Before, if he was going to sign a 7-year, $100 million contract, and he signs with the Yankees, well, who cares that the Yankees have a really tiny park and his skill set doesn't really match up to where to their ballpark, and he probably wouldn't be as good numbers-wise. Well, you know, that wouldn't matter because he's clearing. Those checks are going to clear from the Yankees, I guarantee it. So that wouldn't have been a big deal. But now if he's signing a two-year, even if it's $14 million a year, which I don't think it will be, but might be close, you know, even if he's signing that two-year contract, then you're in a situation where he needs to make sure he's in a position where he's going to succeed like he was last year so that he can move forward and sign another contract, even though he'll be about 35, which, you know, it's a little bit older, but you can still get some good years out of a pitcher from that age. So it's kind of weird where now he has to be a little bit more selective, I think, than he did previously and make sure he's in a good position to succeed. But then also that selectivity comes with the caveat of that team has got to be willing to not only take the risk on Santana, but then give up that draft pick too. So it's kind of a fascinating scenario that I don't know we've seen. I mean, can you remember anything like this in recent history where it's been kind of just such a roller coaster ride, if you will?
I don't know. I mean, I know that last year the Kyle Loesch saga lasted into spring training, which was kind of interesting, and Michael Bourne was kind of late. But it wasn't quite to the extent that, you know, it is with Santana, where, you know, he really thought he was going to get 7 years, and his agents, and they put out a pretty good case saying, hey, here's what Zach Greinke got, here's what Urban Santana has done. And, you know, it was compelling enough that you couldn't really outright dismiss it, but it was still like, you know, he still had the draft pick attached to him. He still had some of that and still kind of a shaky track record, you know, his consistency issues. And I think some people are worried about injuries and anything lurking down the way. But with Loesch, it was like he just kept trying to find a job and nobody would sign him. And, you know, he ended up settling for the Brewers, and it's kind of shaping up that way for Santana. And, you know, Nelson Cruz is still out there. So, I mean, what a team like the Mariners are pretty much, I mean, I think everybody expects Cruz to sign with the Mariners. So that's a draft pick they have to give up. So then what does that do for them trying to get somebody like Santana, who would be a much better fit in that ballpark than he would in Toronto or Baltimore? So what does that do for Santana's demands? And can he then say, hey, look, I know you're going to give up a draft pick, but I'll take a little less money to come here because it's a better fit for me, versus going to Baltimore or Toronto and saying, you know, the two home run stadiums and, you know, just taking whatever the market's going to actually give him, because they're not going after another free agent that's got a draft pick tied to him. So,
and that's actually, I got a question on that. So if you are in a situation like the Mariners where they sign Nelson Cruz and they give up a draft pick and then they sign Urban Santana, like if they don't have another draft pick, I mean, how does that work? Is it just that once you lose one, you might as well sign all the qualified offer free agents because you can't lose any more draft picks? How does that work?
I think they lose their next one. So it would be like first round pick they would lose. The team gets compensation. The next, it would be like second round pick, they would also lose that. Or if they have like a competitive balance or maybe even a compensation pick of their own. I mean, it's not really anything that happened at all last year. So I know it's in the CBA. I don't know the exact rules, but I think it's going to be that where, you know, you lose your highest available draft pick. And then if you sign another one, it would be the very next one. So it's, you know, I mean, that's a tough thing for a team like the Mariners. Maybe they would do that because they seem to be going all in on this year if they go get those guys. You know, they signed Cano, they got Logan Morrison. They seem to be gearing up for that. It seems like they aren't really that concerned, and they've already signed Cano. So that's another draft, that's one pick gone already. So,
and they signed not this year, but, you know, Felix Hernandez, so they've got, I mean, that's a lot of money they've got tied up in him still.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're definitely ready to roll. And the question is that I've wondered recently, where the hell, how does Seattle have all this money all of a sudden? I mean, I remember they had, like, I mean, they had a good team back in the 90s, but that was all, like, developed. You know, they developed all those guys with, you know, Ken Griffey Jr. and Alex Rodriguez and Edgar Martinez and Jay Buhner and all that. Well, I don't know if they, I can't remember if they developed Jay Buhner or not, but.
And they traded for him, but he wasn't a big deal with the Yankees system when they got him. So,
and then they kind of, you know, they had that most wins in a season ever in 2001, I think it was. They won 116 games. So they kind of, you know, it's not like they've, it's unheard of that they've been really good, but it just, where do they get all this money all of a sudden? They're just flashing it like crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, it's, I don't know. It just seems like it must just be an investment by them to just go do it. And they're just tired of losing, which...
That's what it feels like to me, which I'm wondering why that never happens to the Royals.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's kind of refreshing to see someone do it. I don't know if they're doing it the right way or not, but...
Right.
I mean, in 6 years, I mean, what, you know, how, what are they going to look like? But then again, I think we've talked about it a few times, you know, flags fly forever, so...
Yep.
You know, the Marlins don't seem to be begrudging, you know, the constant rebuilding because they've got two World Series trophies. So
I wouldn't either.
No.
If it meant Royals would trade Sal Perez and Hosmer and, you know, Duffy and whoever else and Ventura next year, then to win a World Series this year, you know, see ya. I'll pack their bags. You know, I mean, it would suck to rebuild again, but shoot, as much as we've been through to get a World Series, I'd be fine with that.
I hope we don't have to test that. I hope they can win it, keep them, and just ride it out. But
yeah, try and win two or three in a row before really having
it. Right. Then break it down. That's fine. 2016. All right, that's okay. I think you can.
Okay, we won three straight World Series. You know, then we'll go ahead and we'll trade some of our superstars here.
Right.
After Sal Perez has won his third consecutive league MVP, I can deal with that.
let's try to get odds on that happening.
Yes.
Any of that? Happening. Oh boy. Let's take a break. Let's take a quick break. And then we'll come back. I think we want to talk a little bit about more of this press conference stuff. There, not a whole lot of stuff. I mean, Dayton Moore is pretty famous for saying a lot without saying anything. But there, you know, some interesting tidbits and some kind of reading of the tea leaves. So we'll talk about that here on the other side.
Come to Spit Cup this week. We'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is Jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. No love letters, talking to the wall. Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends. The best pizza in Kansas City and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean, and maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn.
And welcome back to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. We've talked a lot about pitching today, and I think that's pretty important because this year there's going to be a lot riding on the rotation. James Shields, we know, is going to be at the top, but then, you know, like I said before, you've got Vargas, Guthrie, and Chen. All pretty much guaranteed for those spots, at least to start the year. None of them all that exciting, but there is still a fifth spot that's open, and it seems like there may be an actual competition between a number of guys, and two of those are Danny Duffy and Yordano Ventura, you know, obvious favorites of ours. We've talked about Ventura a ton. I think just about everybody, you know, likes Danny Duffy, or at least kind of pulls for him. So the Royals, in this press conference that we referred to earlier, Dayton Moore really seems like he's comfortable with either of these guys being in the bullpen. And I don't know. With Duffy, I think there's signs that with his walk rate, things like that, he would probably have some success there. But at the same time, you want him to be able to start, and you want to see if he can start reliably before you go and just throw him into the bullpen. Ventura, we talked about it last week when we were talking with Jim Callis and talking with Jason Parks. We've talked about it pretty much the whole time he's been a prospect, and at least a notable prospect. Will he be able to stay in the rotation? Is he going to hold up to the workload? So those are two questions. And I'll throw this to you, Jeff. Okay, Danny Duffy into the bullpen. Good move, bad move, whatever move. What are your thoughts?
I think it's a bad move. This organization as a whole has been so starved for good starting pitching, and they've shown a history of starting pitching prospects that go in the bullpen and never leave. I mean, we were talking about it before the show, throwing out some names. You know, Joaquin Soria is a starter, you know, when he was in the Mexican League, and kind of before he started in the minors some. He actually threw a perfect game, if I remember correctly, when he was in the Mexican League. So then you had, you know, Zach Greinke was kind of the exception, but he's the exception in a lot of different ways. and then you have, you know, I mean, Aaron Crow was drafted to be a starter. And they had basically the same exact attitude about Aaron Crow. And they said, okay, you know, we're not afraid to start him off in the bullpen. If he can help this team, let him help this team. You know, I like that idea. I like that philosophy to an extent, but he came up and he was so good that they didn't want him to leave. And so every year since then, we've heard, oh, well, you know, he's going to get a shot at the rotation, but he hasn't really gotten a shot. And, you know, I think it used to be a kind of commonplace scenario where you would, bring a young pitcher up, let him pitch in the bullpen a half a year, and then just kind of let them get a feel for the game and then make that part of their development process towards becoming a starter. But everything's so specialized now, that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have different throwing programs. They have different, you know, philosophies for being a reliever versus being a starter. And really, I don't think it's a good idea because from what I know from the Royals and from what I've seen, I think if Danny Duffy goes in the bullpen and has success, he's not coming out. We will not see him get back to that starter role. And they need Danny Duffy to be a starter and to be a good one. So, I mean, I think you got to go out there and you say, hey, man, your walk rate is too high. Stop walking people. You know, that's on you. And let's make you a starter. And then if you can't cut it, then you know, you go the Hochever route and you move him back, you move him into the bullpen where you think he can have. Because I think a bullpen, when you've got someone like a Danny Duffy who's got that kind of stuff, and Hochever proved it, mm-hmm. basically, where if you've got somebody who's got that kind of stuff, they can be successful in the bullpen. He can be successful in short stints, and he would be. So why not try and get the most out of him, keep him be a starter like they did with Hochever, and instead of just starting him out in the bullpen? Because, you know, when young players don't get that shot like a Hochever did and get moved to the bullpen, seem to come out, at least in the Royals organization. So I want to see Danny Duffy as a starter. I don't want to see him start in the bullpen.
Yeah, and I think I have to agree with that just because, I mean, you're right. That used to be kind of the way that teams would bring guys up. You know, I think Brett Saberhagen was kind of brought up that way, and I believe Mark Gubazov for a little bit. Where you know, you start him in the bullpen, but it's at the same time where a lot of guys would come into the bullpen in the sixth inning and they would finish out the game. So you could still get a good amount of innings on just a few bullpen appearances, just because you know there was you would only have 8 or 9 pitchers on your pitching staff instead of 12 or even 13 in some cases. So it is going to be definitely a different kind of environment for a guy being moved to the bullpen in today's game, because you know they're only looking for those guys to do maybe 2 innings max unless they are a long relief guy. So I think with Duffy, it's like you said, you got to get what you can out of him and learn now if he's going to be able to do it, because you never know. I mean, he could break out. He's got the good curveball, he's got a good fastball. Change up the other stuff, it's kind of okay. the control is really the thing. The control is going to dictate so much of it. If he's walking people, he's going to have high pitch counts. It's going to limit what he can do. If he can only do 4 or 5 innings, then, yeah, if that's what it turns out, that's pretty much what you have to go with. But at the same time, if he can start, you need him to start. I mean, he needs to be doing that. I've got Michael Wacha pulled up here just because I do, and that'll be a little bit later. But, you know, last year for the Cardinals, you know, he made 3 starts before July, just kind of spot starts. And then in August, they pretty much were using him out of the bullpen all month until September. And then once rosters expanded, they were able to use him as a starter. And, you know, he showed a lot of success. And then later, you know, he was NLCS MVP and looked like a really, really great pitcher. And buying him out as the starter, if the Royals are like that, I'm kind of okay. I could see something where, like, you've got Bruce Chen who's game, and maybe he's only able to go 4 innings or so, and then you come in with Danny Duffy right behind him, and, you know, you go from that 85-mile-per-hour fastball to 5. I could see something like that working. But I don't know. I think you can't really look at him full-time as a reliever and expect a lot of success. And it's just kind of, you know, it's like you said, they go in, they don't come out. It's the bullpen black hole is what it looks like. So, you know, that kind of applies to Ventura too. And he, I would really worry about in that case, because he's got such an arm. We've talked about his secondary stuff with Jason Parks and Jim Callis and others, you know, about, you know, how good he could be. And if he can do that workload. And one of the things that came out of this press conference earlier today was that Dayton Moore expects him, or not expects, he thinks that he can throw 200 innings this year. So just kind of looking at it, Ventura, you know, his first full season league, you know, he threw 84.1 innings. His second season, I threw 109.1. So he had an increase of 25 innings. You know, which is kind of reasonable. It's about 30%. And then between 2012 and 2013, he went from 109.1 to 150 innings. So I think a 20% increase would put him at 180. So, yeah, maybe he can do that. And it all kind of depends on how he can handle major league hitters. And so, you know, you look at someone like, say, a Michael Wacha, who I just talked about. You know, he threw about 67 innings as a rookie between, and I'm counting his college numbers too, just because that's his full season. And then he jumped up last year, threw 149.2 innings between AAA and the majors, and then threw another 30 innings in the playoffs. So I want the Royals to be looking at that as an example of what you can do with some of these young guys. Put them in the rotation, give them the opportunity to do something, and if for some reason the roster shakes out, you know, keep them in mind and be ready to put them back in the rotation. I think with Duffy and Ventura, you've got to have that approach, because if those two guys aren't starters, I don't know what you do, because then you're looking at Wade Davis, Luke Hochaver, Brad Penny as that fifth starter. None of those guys seem appealing.
Yeah, and I think you saw last year a couple of things that kind of lend to one of your earlier points, Mike, where you saw Luis Mendoza, who, you know, everybody, he had a good finish to 2012, and so people were kind of excited, what can he do, can he really help this team? And he got off to a decent start in 2013 and then just kind of imploded and just pitched too many innings, they said. And then you had Bruce Chen, who started off the season in the bullpen and then comes on in the second half of the year and pitches great as, you know, as a starter. So with Bruce Chen coming back, you've got a situation where somebody is Bruce Chen on the staff is someone who probably can't get through a full season. He probably can't throw the 200 innings anymore and be effective while doing it, I should say. So there you're in a situation where you have that Michael Wacha scenario type thing where, okay, Bruce Chen is going to get, you know, 2 starts, and then maybe Ventura or Duffy gets the third, or you kind of ease them in that first half, come back. So, I mean, the Royals have some options to play with. It's just they haven't demonstrated in the past an ability to recognize those situations where they can leverage something to help their players develop better, which is obviously something the Cardinals do incredibly well. So, I mean, I really think it would be it'll be interesting to see with Duffy, Ventura, and possibly Zimmer in the second half of the year all being theoretically ready to come up and make something happen, you know, how they really work with that development, and if they can finally put some things together and develop a starting pitcher.
Yeah, and I think that's Leske was talking about that in one of his notes columns about combining those four, you know, Chen, Ventura, Duffy, and Zimmer, and getting about 70 starts combined out of them. And maybe that's the way it's going to end up. I mean, certainly Chen, I don't think, is going to last through the whole season. I imagine the Royals kind of know that. Ventura, there's going to be a question. Even if he might be able to throw 200 innings, I don't know that he necessarily should, because that's a pretty big jump on a guy that you already have that question about how he can hold up over a year. Duffy, I mean, is he even going to be able to throw enough innings to do that with the kind of pitch counts he's doing? If he's at 15 pitches an inning, he can probably do it. If he's at 17, 18, probably not, just because sooner or later he's going to hit 100 pitches before five innings and you got to pull him. And that's just kind of the thing that you run into. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they leverage that. And on top of that, you've also got, you know, Kyle Zimmer is kind of the wild card in that, because it sounds like the Royals are looking to delay some of his throwing, or at least his game experience this year, because they see him as a guy that they're going to need in August, the playoff run, which that's ambitious. You know, and I think he's a pretty good bet to be a guy who can come in and have that kind of David Price role, where he comes in, makes his debut, nobody has a book on him, and he goes through and kind of tears up the league. But at the same time, you know, what does that say about what Zimmer can do if they're already looking to hold him back in this area or that? So, you know, it's all about workloads. I mean, you know, compared some of these guys to Michael Wacha, and it's kind of the same thing. I think Zimmer and Wacha are probably going to be compared all the time. And article by Andy McCullough, his first one for the Star since joining, made that direct comparison, where Piccolo was talking about what Wacha did last year. And that's what the Royals see Zimmer doing this year. But it all comes down to workload. I mean, he threw 108.1 innings last year. So I don't think you can see him doing more than 150 this year, just because you've got the tendonitis that he had last year that shut him down early. You've got the bone chips right after after 2012 when he was drafted. So there's definite questions. And, you know, we talked about it on last week's show, where, you know, converted players who start to pitch sometimes get hurt, as Jason Park said. And that's definitely a concern. So, you know, I would like to see Zimmer pitching all year round. You know, it might be something where this is the right move. I'm just not sure. It doesn't feel intuitively like it is, just because, you know, anytime you start delaying a guy's start, you know, then what does that do for the rest of their season? Do they ever get going? You know, is it something where they have to go from 0 to 60 and they can't do it? I don't know. So Zimmer's going to be an interesting test case for that. I'm interested to see how that turns out, and if he's actually able to make some starts later in the year, middle of the season, or even just in September.
Yeah, and you know, I see two angles to that. One, you know, if the Royals are going to go all in, saying we want to make the playoffs, then I think they kind of have to act accordingly. And part of that is being able to get in a position where you have that extra bullet in the chamber, and Zimmer might be it. That's one angle. The other angle is the Royals, sometimes it seems like they just try to exercise too much control over roster management, whether it's for salary concerns like Moustakas in 2011, where everybody was saying he was ready to come up and start the season with the big leagues, and they didn't want the Super 2 status, and so they didn't want him to start the season, blah, blah, blah. And they do kind of things like that. But, you know, with Zimmer, and especially coming from college, being, you know, making the switch, like you said, from position to pitching kind of later than most people, the Royals, I feel like, really need to kind of sit back and just let him dictate how he gets through the system and when he can come up, when he's ready. And trying to exercise that much control, I think it does exactly what you kind of suggested, which is, you know, going from maybe 0 to 60 or whatever the case, when you jerk somebody around and you kind of, for lack of a better term, and you don't really give them an opportunity to get into a place where they can get into a routine, they can be successful, they can, you know, have comfort level when they constantly don't know what they're doing. Am I sitting? Am I playing? Am I in double A, triple A? Am I going to the majors? You know, where am I starting? What am I pitching? Bullpen, whatever. That can really throw a guy off, and that can stunt some development. So, I mean, that's a concern. And that's something that, I mean, you know, no doubt the Royals are probably trying to manage as well, but, you know, they haven't necessarily shown that they've been the best at it in the past. So it does kind of give me the same level of apprehension that you were suggesting when you hear something like that, that they might kind of be trying to massage this thing out to work perfectly. Well, you know, theoretically, see where that could be advantageous, but at the same time, the Royals being the Royals, I still don't know that they're in a position to do that. I think they kind of need to, especially someone who's as important as Zimmer is to this franchise, just kind of let that thing play out on its own.
Yeah, and the thing that kind of gives me a little bit of solace is that last year when, you know, he made that adjustment in Wilmington and started striking everybody out, had four really good starts, they moved him up right away. And at least at that point, they were listening to what the performance was telling them. I think they kind of did that a little bit with Ventura as well, where, you know, he was having success in double A, they moved him into triple A, he was continuing to have success, and then they brought him up for three starts in September. So maybe that signals a shift. Maybe it's just these two particular guys, because they are the top two prospects in the system, that, you know, are so important and so close to the majors relative to other prospects. So I really want to see what happens with those guys. I really think Ventura needs to start the year in the big leagues if he can do it. I think I said it last week where you know, he only signed for $28,000. So if they're concerned about Super 2 status, I'm pretty sure he would be open to something that gave him a little more up front, that maybe gives you some savings on the back end of his team control years. Yeah, I would imagine he's going to be open to that.
Yeah, there's no reason he can't be like Escobar or Perez, where you can lock him up for just some ludicrously team-friendly deal for 5, 6, 7 years and buy out some free agency and get some option years and give him some, you know, $5-10 million up front or whatever it is, and, you know, then you've got him for his prime, and you kind of driving the bus on that one. I see no reason why that couldn't happen. I'm 100% agreement there.
And the other thing is, like, let's say he can't cut it as a starter. Well, you've got Greg Holland, who's probably going to go to arbitration, probably going to get $5.2 million this year. You know, that's his first year of arbitration. So what's he going to get next year? You know, $8 million, $9 million? And the year after that, you know, $12, $13 million? Who knows how much he's going to be getting if he continues to be the lockdown closer he is. At some point, the Royals, you know, let's say Ventura doesn't cut it as a starter, but they want to make him the closer. Well, now you've still got him, you know, maybe you've got that long-term contract, but you're not paying him as a starter, you're paying him as a closer. It's still the same kind of thing where you can save some money, you know, throughout the life of the contract, because you're not paying him those crazy arbitration increases year by year. So the only thing that really would break it up is if Ventura just got hurt and was never the same again, which is possible. And it's definitely, I mean, he's a pitcher, and even if he's a smaller pitcher, big pitcher, pitchers get hurt. So I understand if they're not going to do that this year, or if they're going to wait, you know, if they were going to do something like that, I would imagine it would be right after this season.
Yeah, I mean, if he comes out and, you know, say he pitches 170 innings and they make the playoffs and he, you know, does well, even if they don't make the playoffs, you know, if he can do 170 innings of below 4 ERA and strike out 8-9 batters per 9 innings like he's shown that he can do, then I think you'd be in a real good position to try and lock him up and say, okay, you know, yeah, it was only one season, but, you know, we've seen him his whole career. We think he can do this. Why not? Yeah. So I think after this season is a prime time because they're going to get a real good look at him and see kind of what he's made of.
Well, another thing you just said, I mean, they've had him in the system since he was 16. So, I mean, they know who he is. They know how he works. So, you know, I think that bodes well. And Sal Perez was the same way. They had him from such a young age. They knew how he was able to handle himself and how he approached preparation and everything. So maybe that's going to factor in, too, because they're younger guys. I don't, you know, I think Sal is an interesting case because, you know, he kind of set – he's, if the Royals don't do that with him, the idea of Ventura being a Super 2 or buyout guy doesn't really come up because it doesn't seem like the Royals have a test case on it. So that's an interesting wrinkle to see how they handle that situation and go from there.
And I think, too, just one last thing on that. When, if you set up someone like a Yordano Ventura and he's, what, 23? Is he 23 or 24?
He'll turn 23 in June.
23, okay. So he's 23, set him up on a five-year contract with two option years, and, you know, after this season. And then, so he'd be 30 by the end of that contract, theoretically. Well, then once you get to, you know, that fourth or fifth year, if he continues to be good, then you've still got him under contract, but then you can try and extend him or extend that contract or give him one. And you can save money there, too, because it seems like players that do that, like an Evan Longoria or somebody else like that, that comes up and kind of signs that early contract, then when their next contract comes in, it's usually before their first one is out. It's a substantial raise, but all the same, it's not necessarily what they could get on the open market. You know, because it's when you go from, like, Sal Perez's contract is 8 years, was like $24 million, something ridiculous. So if they come in in year six and say, okay, we're going to extend you for another 5 years at, you know, $50 million, well, he might be able to go out and get 5 years, $75 million at that point. But, you know, he's sitting there thinking, okay, well, I've still got 2 years on this contract, but right now I can set up and guarantee myself twice as much as I already made. So, I mean, I think that kind of factors in, and you can kind of give yourself a little bit more leverage too. So just something to think about.
Yeah,
because, you know, the Royals listen to us and what we say.
Sure, of course they do. they do a funny job of executing it, though.
Yes.
And you know, hey, since we're speaking about extending contracts, let's go back into the past. And might remember in 2002 when the Royals signed Mike Sweeney to, I think it was a five-year, $55 million contract. Biggest one in franchise history to that point.
Oh, yes.
Felt like, okay, fine, we're not going to have to worry about trading, you know, Johnny Damon and Jermaine Dye anymore. And, of course, you know, he still hit like crazy, but he was hurt a lot. And I think a lot of people soured on him. Well, now he's got a front office job with the Royals. Apparently he had some hitting coach jobs, but he turned them down because he wanted to work with Kansas City, which makes sense. He spent a lot of his time here. He's a five-time All-Star with the Royals, still involved in a lot of things. He was at the celebrity softball game in 2012 during the All-Star break, and he's in the booth once or twice a year during Royals broadcasts. So, and he probably still lives around here, or maybe he has a home in Kansas City and in California, I think, is where he's from. So,
yeah,
you know, my first thought was really, well, what's he going to do? I mean, what's the country club in California going to do without him golfing those 2 weeks of the year? I mean, he says he's going to have some on-field involvement, and it sounds kind of almost like kind of a mentor role of a sort. You know, these kinds of things, I think it's good to have those guys around. I mean, George Brett has been like assistant vice president or something since he retired, you know. But honestly, I think he's getting paid to be George Brett. Same thing. He's getting paid to be Mike Sweeney. Frank White was getting paid to be Frank White, except White, of course, wanted to be a broadcaster, and he wanted to be a manager, and these other things came up. So I think it's newsworthy. I think it's at least interesting, but I don't think it's going to really have much of an impact in a lot of ways. it's kind of window dressing to me.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's kind of funny when you step back and you look at Mike Sweeney, and the dude just straight up loves Kansas City. I mean, for all the complaining that we do as a city about athletes not wanting to come here and all that kind of stuff, we sure take for granted the ones that really enjoy being here and genuinely love Kansas City. You know, like Sweeney caught a lot of heat from the fans when he was having injury problems. Butler catches a lot of heat. I mean, constantly. We've talked about that tons on this show. Mm-hmm. And those are, when you look back at the last 10 years, you know, those are probably the two players who have enjoyed and made it known how much they want to be in Kansas City the most. Whereas you've got a guy like, you know, Alex Gordon, and not that he's been any sort of malcontent or anything, but he's just kind of a more quiet, kind of a less, well, he hasn't really said he wants to, how much he loves Kansas City, and, you know, he's got some kind of family ties to the area, more or less, but, you know, you haven't really, the guys like Billy Butler, who've just been outspoken about how, you know, wanting to stay in Kansas City their whole career, and, you know, Sweeney did at one point, and that didn't quite work out, but that was just kind of at the end of it anyway. So it's kind of interesting to me that, you know, it's good that he's back, and I definitely like it when you have those kind of really good athletes. Who back in his day, I mean, in his prime, Sweeney was recognized as one of the prominent hitters in the American League. So
yeah.
On any other team besides the Royals, I mean, he would have been a star, but he was on a bunch of crappy Royals teams, so he kind of got lost in everything else. But, you know, it's good to see players that really enjoy the town. They like Kansas City. They want to be in the Royals organization, and because you don't see many of them from the Royals, so
right,
it's good to see that. But all the same, like you said, I see on the impactometer about a 1% level. So I don't really think this measures very highly on the Richter scale.
No, there's going to be plenty of milk and cookies in the clubhouse, though. So there's bananas. That at least. Yeah.
maybe that's where Irvin Santana got the banana last year.
Why isn't Sweeney recruiting him that way? I mean,
I know. Look at all these.
Everybody
bananas.
Knows that Irvin Santana is always sitting in the dugout eating a banana. I never see that with any other players, and so there we go. We were going to make more jokes about Sweeney, but, you know, really, when I was growing up and when I was that age, Sweeney was pretty much my favorite player on those teams. I'm always, you know, partial to the first baseman because George Brett was my favorite player, and he just flipped the diamond, play first when I really started catching on to baseball. So I'm biased towards first baseman pretty much at all times. Even Bob Hamlin, I really like Bob Hamlin. So
the Hammer.
Yeah.
I like people like Sweeney, and I think it's one of the reasons that I like Butler so much is because they're really, like, you know, you have, let's say, we talked about Nelson Cruz earlier. When I look at Nelson Cruz play baseball, I look at someone who is very athletic and just kind of knows. You know, he goes out there, he's like, I can do this, and he goes out there and plays. Whereas, not to say that Sweeney and Butler aren't athletic, because they definitely are, but just the idea that those two, you know, just being the most prominent examples that I think of from a Royals perspective, and of course George Brett, but he's really of that era. The idea that they're kind of technicians, you know, they really have turned hitting into a craft, you know, and it was like, I can really appreciate that. I think that you know, that's a valuable skill, not only having the athletic ability, the hand-eye coordination, all that thing that goes into it, but then really, you know, concentrating on an approach. It's something where, you know, maybe the impact is more than 1%, because maybe Sweeney can be the guy that talks Mike Moustakas into actually watching some film or doing something of that nature. You know, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that really kind of takes it to the next level. And so it's definitely something that you always kind of saw with Mike Sweeney, you could appreciate. He was really, you know, he had a very good approach. He was incredibly talented, and you know, I like that about him, that it wasn't all just this freak athletic ability. It was something else there that, not that I'm trying to take any away from people that are just freakishly athletic or that, mm-hmm. you know, are different. It just, And I kind of like that aspect of players like that.
Yeah, they have to work a little bit for it and put in a different kind of effort. So it makes sense. And Sweeney came up, he was like a backup pitcher and really just kind of got thrown in there because Jeff King retired in the middle of the season. I think that's what the story was. And ended up hitting. So, you know, just kind of ended up hitting like crazy, you know, pretty much once he was a full-time guy. So, you know, he's a good story and, you know, good for him. And, you know, just kind of dreading seeing he and Rex Hudler in the booth at the same time because they're going to just chatter for a whole inning and it's going to be obnoxious. But, you know, what can you do? You just have to deal with it. At least it'll be baseball. So there's that.
That's true.
All right, so we're going to take you to the interview, the discussion with Brett Parker about Dress to the Nines. This is something that's being done with a lot of support from the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. It's May 18th. He's got a lot of cool information about like how the event started and some of the things that are coming up. So take a listen to that, and then we will be right back for the final wrap-up. And welcome back to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Right now, we're going to talk to our guest, Brett Parker, who was one of the originators of a very interesting event last year. And I say this all the time, that Royals fans and Kansas City fans are some of the best baseball fans out there. I think you saw that in 2012 for the All-Star Game. I think you saw that last year during the pennant chase. But this was a pretty unique event, and Kansas City was the forefront of it. So, Brett, we're talking about Dress to the Nines, which was kind of an official, unofficial thing last year, but it wasn't the first time that you've gone out and put on a suit and a hat and everything. So tell me about, you know, how this event, how this idea first came about and the first time you went, you know, dressed to the nines to a ball game.
Sure. Well, one of my buddies and I, Brad, and I were both kind of inspired by what we had seen at the Negro Leagues Museum and just kind of baseball history nerds in general, you know, love the Ken Burns series. And a couple of years ago, we realized that Jackie Robinson Day fell on a Sunday, and we thought that would be a cool way to honor that, would be to, you know, throw on some vintage suits and go out to the game like everyone really did for baseball games back in, you know, the 30s and 40s. But more specifically, the way Monarchs fans used to in Kansas City, put on their best clothes, go to church. The black churches would really even bump up their service time an hour earlier so everyone could head out to the game afterwards and walk over and just treat it like it's the social of the year, really. So we threw on some suits and went to that game and just did it for fun and had quite a few people take a liking to it and have their pictures taken. And so last spring, we were sitting around at a game on a Saturday night and thought, hey, that'd be fun. Let's do it again. And we were throwing around dates for it because you can't do it too late in the year or it's not really suit weather anymore. No one really wants to sweat through a game in July in a heavy suit. So we settled on 8 days from that day, and happened to be Cinco de Mayo by coincidence, and went, yeah, let's see if we can get, you know, a handful of people. I think we would have been content if the backseat of our car also contained people dressed up instead of just the two of us. And went home that night, and a couple of us sent out some tweets. I think I tweeted Sly James and definitely tweeted the Negro Leagues Museum, and it got a retweet here and there. And then thanks to a lot of the followers of Bob Kendrick at the Negro Leagues Museum, we kept getting people say, hey, what a great idea. We'd love to be a part of that. You know, we'll get some friends out. And gosh, over the course of the week, it went from, hey, fun idea. Maybe we'll run into someone else dressed up at the game to, I'm not sure if you wrote about it specifically, but I know a couple of the bloggers wrote about it. Casey Starr ran it under Mellinger's column. We were shocked one night that week to see it on Fox News. And then kind of the culmination of all of that, though, was that Fox Sports really picked up on it and had Bob Kendrick on for the pregame show and did an interview with him, and they put on their fedoras for the pregame, and Nate Buchady on the, you know, down on the field was wearing his suit and vest and hat, and they invited all of us to go sit in the general area around or stand around the pregame show and put us in the background. And so, I mean, you were out there. I would guess we had about 50 or so for the pregame and then saw a scattering of other people around the stadium. So, you know, a little bit more than the carload we were looking for initially. And then the big shock of it all was the next day, I think that Monday, I had I work at a school, and one of the other teachers came up to me and said, "Hey, do you realize your picture's on the Yahoo homepage?" What? We pulled that up, and sure enough, they had written an article on there, and I think it ended up on CBS Sports website too. And so we were just—I mean, it was just a week of like, this can't be real. Every step was just a bigger one along the way. So that's kind of the long-winded history of it, I suppose.
And the thing that struck me was this came together really quickly. I mean, like you said, it was an 8-day kind of planning thing where you didn't really know what was going to happen. And, you know, it was such a good idea. And I think it resonated so well with a lot of people that, you know, Mellinger picked it up. Mellinger's a KC guy. And, you know, Bob Kendrick threw his support behind it right away. And those are two pretty good voices in the Kansas City sports scene to get involved. And then, you know, again, you get onto Fox Sports Kansas City, and it's now picked up to where this year you guys have, it's an official event at the Royals game. It's not just like something that's organized grassroots style. It's something that's caught on to the extent that a major league team has actually gone out to, you know, there's going to be a fedora giveaway. They're going to have a lot of other things going on. So when you were at the original one, or at least last year's, what were your thoughts going into it, and did you have any kind of thought that this would be possible to get it this big so fast?
No thought of that whatsoever. I think the most we were looking for was, you know, let's just get a few other diehard baseball fans or, you know, baseball history nerds out, and, you know, our goal is really just let's bump into a couple people we've never met before who are doing the same thing. And maybe, you know, send some love towards the Negro Leagues Museum, since that's kind of our experience there, and getting to go there is what spawned the idea. But, you know, the idea of the Royals picking it up as a promotion, I don't think ever occurred to us until we were sitting down at the game and Bob came in after a couple innings of, you know, walking around chatting with people and said, "Yeah, Toby Cook was talking about next year they're going to put it on the schedule," and we were just blown away. It's already beyond our wildest dreams, but the way that it's taken off and the resonance it seems to have around Kansas City, we're pretty excited to see, you know, what next year looks like, or what this year looks like and where it will go from there. But it doesn't seem like the growth is stopping anytime soon, so we're pretty excited about that.
I know some of the ideas that you guys have tossed around are things like a jazz performance of the national anthem, or, you know, different jazz bands at some of the gates. Are any of those things coming together now, or are they still in the works? And what else is kind of planned around that particular day at the ballpark?
Yeah. As far as national anthem, I mean, that's something that the Royals have to approve, but we sat down with Bob Kendrick last month and he was pretty confident that we'd be able to get maybe a solo trumpetist from around Kansas City playing that. We're trying to organize some jazz probably at our tailgate. And then what I would love to see is every entrance, you know, have a duet or a trio just playing, so that there's an instant connection point for anyone going to the game, you know, even if they've never heard of Dress the Nines Day, that they see something a little bit different about that. So that's one of the add-ons we're doing this year. One of the things we're really excited about is Ryan Mabey of Manifesto and the Rieger and Kill Devil Club downtown, one of the top bartenders in Kansas City, has also turns out a big baseball and history fan. And so he's going to be on board and do some signature cocktails for us. And hopefully we'll be able to do those for donations at our tailgate and donations to the museum. And that'll be another draw to get people out. But that's one of the fun things about this is that, you know, it lends itself to jazz and that era. And then also kind of the Prohibition nightclub era of Kansas City that seems to be kind of back on the rise at this time too. So there's a lot of tie-ins we're hoping to add on this year.
And you're talking about the tailgate, is that's going to be, and the game is going to be May 18th. That's the date for this.
Yeah,
Dress
thank
to
you
the
for
Nine.
Putting that in there.
We should definitely have people mark their calendars for that. But you're talking about a tailgate, what is that going to be, like one big thing that people are just going to be invited to, or is that something that the Royals are trying to get behind as well?
Well, at this point, the goal would be, if the Royals are on board, to, you know, get an official tent set up near the stadium, and it would be one big thing. And the nice thing about it is it's a connection point, so, you know, if someone and two of their friends want to throw on suits and go to the game, think we all experienced last year getting out of the car and walking into the stadium and going, all right, what am I getting myself into here? You know, am I going to see anyone else looking the same? I mean, we, I think, practically jumped up and down when we saw two strangers walking in the same gate as us dressed up. So the nice thing about a tailgate is it's a nice central rallying point for everyone. You can kind of come in, meet other people involved, like we all ended up doing at the Rivals Bar last year. But again, you know, hopefully we'll have some nice draws there with Ryan maybe there. Bob will be out there. We are hoping that there might be a Negro League celebrity or Royals baseball celebrity or two in the area. We're kind of in some preliminary discussions with a few of them, so hopefully we'll have some announcements about that coming up. And then one of the ideas that we're pretty excited about too is setting up a photo booth at our pregame, so you know, everyone's decked out in their best costumes and have the chance to, if nothing else, get a digital copy of, you know, some nice photos from a professional photographer that can put on your Facebook after and brag to all your friends about what you did. So.
And a lot of this is done, I mean, we've talked a lot about Bob Kendrick on our show, and obviously he was involved last year. A lot of this is done with the support of and in support of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. I mean, I know you're a history guy. I mean, obviously, if this is your idea of you know, a pretty wild day at the ballpark, this is definitely a history buff's kind of thing. Tell me about the first time you went to the museum and, you know, some of your thoughts and thoughts now after being there a couple times.
Sure. Well, I had been, I think probably a handful of years ago, probably 7 or 8 years ago, went for the first time and enjoyed it. But what really sold me is my senior year of my undergrad at UMKC, they actually offered a class. We got to do a Black Baseball as American Culture class that took place at the museum. And so for 3 hours every week, we met at the museum. We got to meet the curator there. We got to, you know, go around and do our research in the museum. And then the other thing that really drew me into it is they had a whole week's worth of Jackie Robinson celebrations. And in my class, they gave us extra credit for it. And so I wasn't, as a baseball nerd and also just trying to get an A in the class, wasn't going to pass up the chance to, you know, kill two birds with one stone. And so what really inspired Brad and I, my buddy who started it with me, is we went to Jackie Robinson Day. They had a panel discussion with former Negro Leagues players at the museum and, you know, and former umpires and Hilton Smith's son, who was a bat boy for the Monarchs. So we got to go to that game. We go to that discussion, hung around the museum a little bit. I think we both bought Monarchs jerseys that day. Went to a game and they're wearing their throwback jerseys. And then after the game, there was actually another panel discussion back at the museum with Brian McRae and Willie Wilson. And so just to spend an entire day that week just immersed in the stories of the Negro Leagues and the tradition and the pride that was around it, you know, especially even with the fans going out to the games and really taking pride in the way that they were dressed and the fact that they got to be a part of that proud tradition with the Monarchs. I think that's what really sold us, was just getting to be immersed in that for a little while. And so, you know, as it came together last year, that was one of the things that we were excited about, is you kind of recreate that day or that experience for some other people, that they can come out, you know, pay homage to this great Kansas City history and tradition, and kind of honor the Negro Leagues Museum that has been there to teach the rest of us about this as well.
Now, May 18th is going to be Dressed to the Nines Day. You know, the reaction that I saw from a lot of different sources, you know, as you said before, you guys ended up on Yahoo. There were other blogs and other websites and other places that picked it up as well. Have any other teams or any other fans of other teams contacted you guys about any of these ideas, or are there other plans in other cities to try to do something like this?
Yeah, we're really interested in trying to make it an event around the league. I think especially since the Royals have picked it up as an official event and kind of I like the way that they're making it the fans' way of participating in the Salute to the Negro Leagues Day. And since there are so many other cities around the league with that shared history and who also do, you know, throwback to the Negro Leagues days, Detroit and Washington and Pittsburgh and Atlanta and several of them do it. So I think that's one of the key areas for growth we're looking at. We would love to see some just kind of grassroots fan movements in some of those cities this year. There's actually a graphic designer from Brooklyn, he's now in Virginia, who contacted me last year right after and said, hey, I had a similar idea. I love what you guys did. How can we spread this and, you know, just make it a thing that fans can do around the country? So we're toying with some ideas on how to spread that. I think if it's a success for the Royals this year, that will go a long way in them kind of sharing that idea with other clubs and getting the teams to look at it officially. But from our point of view, the best way to get this to spread around the league this year is just to make it, you know, a crazy success in Kansas City, that this year we really put our stamp on it and that the Royals are behind it. And, you know, if we can make it a great experience for them and a great experience for the fans, that's really the way to turn around next year, you know, reach out to the Washington Nationals or Pittsburgh Pirates and say, hey, you guys have the same history, you know, how can we get you involved with it? And especially, I would love to see, you know, the Baltimore Orioles come away from this game since they're the opponent and go, wow, you know, we couldn't believe it. The fans were filled with, you know, fans were filled with fans wearing fedoras, and, you know, we'd love to see something like that back in Baltimore. So I know Bob at the museum is really excited about the potential of growing it around the league, especially if we can kind of keep pointing back to, you know, our institution here in Kansas City of the museum and, you know, get that on the map for baseball fans in other cities as a place to visit or something to donate proceeds to. One of the nice things this year is the Royals, I believe, are setting aside a special section for us officially, not, you know, not just throwing out a section number and everyone trying to buy in it like we did last year. And one of the benefits of that is some of the proceeds will actually go to the museum. So
oh, fantastic.
Our dream would be if other teams picked that up, that then they would honor that same arrangement and we could, you know, continue to make this a nice attention getter, but also fundraiser for the museum.
Well, I mean, you've got me sold. I think it's an awesome idea. I had a blast last year doing this, and you're right. It is kind of a weird feeling to be walking up to the stadium, passing people cooking hot dogs on a grill while you're wearing a fedora. But it's totally worth it once you're in there. I was around with you guys, and it was, you know, you guys were hollering, heckling from the crowd and everything. I thought it was great. So everybody who's listening, I really think you should go check this out. Again, May 18th. If people are looking for more information, where can they find that?
Sure. Right now, there's a Facebook event. It's just called Dressed to the Nines Day. And so if you search that on Facebook, I think we've gotten enough traffic there. That should pop up pretty quickly. Definitely follow at NLBMPrez with a Z on Twitter. That's Bob Kendrick's Twitter handle. And he, if you don't follow me, he pretty much retweets anything that we've said about the Nines, which is very generous of him. And then you can also follow me on Twitter, and I'm just at the Brett, two T's in Brett, but then also my middle initial T, Parker. Nice and confusing there. At the Brett. Three T's in the middle there, Parker, and about 90% of what I send out on Twitter is just related to Dressed to the Nines in some way. We are launching our own Twitter handle, but it hasn't started sending anything out yet, and if it does, you'll see it retweeted by myself or Bob Kendrick pretty quickly. So I would recommend, above and beyond anything, following Bob Kendrick, and that's at NLBMPrez with a Z. On Twitter. And again, the Facebook event page will be posting everything to there as well. So those are the two nice connection points. Of course, if you can't find any of those things and you follow Mellinger on Twitter, you can tweet him questions about it, and I'm sure he'll point you in our direction as well. And also the guys at Fox Sports have been pretty nice about that too.
Yep, and I'll be chattering about it too. So anybody who's listening to our show, they probably follow me. I hope they follow me.
Yeah.
If they don't, well, I don't blame them really either. But all right, so that's going to be Dressed to the Nines Day again, May 18th. You definitely have to check it out. If nothing else, you know, go to the game. If you're kind of self-conscious about it, see the fun that we're having. And then maybe in 2015, there you go. You might try.
Well, and at the very least, the Royals will hand you a fedora on the way in, so you won't look too out of place.
Exactly, exactly. All right, thanks, Brett, for sharing that information. We're going to try to do what we can to get things out there. Bob's always been a really good friend of ours on this show, so anything that helps Bob definitely helps us in our minds. So
Again, well, thanks for giving me a chance to get the word out. You know, the more people we can get on board now, the bigger we can get with momentum as it gets closer. So we're pretty excited to see how big we can make this.
Absolutely. Again, May 18th, dressed to the nines. Let's see you out there. We'll be back. And that was Brett Parker. You can follow him at the Brett T. Parker on Twitter. And of course, we'll be passing along updates on Dress to the Nines as it gets closer. We may even have him back on late April or so, just to see what the latest updates are. Of course, working with Bob Kendrick, I mean, awesome guy, does so much stuff and knows just about everybody in Kansas City. Last note before we get out of here, part of this press conference that we've talked a bit about, Dayton Moore, the sound of it was that Bubba Starling is going to start in Wilmington, which is an interesting place to put him because it's kind of tough on right-handed hitters and it's really not good for home runs. But Rainey Jazierli has a pretty good article out on his blog, Rainey on the Royals, about some of the implications of that. Basically, the idea, if Bubba can succeed there, he'll be probably okay. So we'll see. I think that's an interesting place to put him. His defense and speed is definitely going to play in the outfield there, but I don't know how he's going to hit. That's going to be interesting to see. And the other thing that kind of came out, Jason Adam is likely to start in AA, which I don't think we were too surprised to hear that just because he did struggle some last year. And just because he starts there doesn't mean that, you know, he gives five starts in AA and then immediately jumps up to AAA and kind of goes from there. So we're definitely rooting for him. Obviously, Troy's partial to Jason Adam just a bit. So hopefully we can get Jason on the show to maybe talk once the season starts, or, you know, if he does get a promotion to Omaha, and we'll just kind of see what happens. But that's pretty much about all I've got. Do you have anything else, Jeff?
No, I think we pretty much covered everything.
All right. So that's everything Royals. But, of course, there's going to be more developments. So listen to the other folks on the Royals Podcast Network. You can find us on Stitcher. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on SoundCloud. Course, we're going to be talking to you on Twitter, making sure you get every new episode. So check those out and vote Royal Man.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
That was a crappy ending, but we'll work with it.
Got it. We got it.
Whatever. All right.